following is a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing. On. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 16 days into the month of June. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, an interview with Olivia from Rakow, featuring Avalanche contributor Emma. All that right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You're listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at @AvalancheCKUT.
We've all learned from COVID-19 is that something small can spread quickly, like a ripple. If enough of us do our part by getting vaccinated, we can start a wave. A wave of Canadians helping each other return to the people and places we love. We can all help by getting vaccinated. Learn more at canada.ca/COVID-vaccine. A message from the Government of Canada.
The global outbreak of COVID-19 has affected all our lives in various ways, and it has notably drawn our attention to the intensified systemic racism and selective xenophobia towards our racialized friends in our Canadian society. It is understandable for each of us to feel anxious about this fatal disease. However, the sentiment of fear does not give us the right or the opportunity to conduct hate crime and to discriminate against our Asians, Blacks, Indigenous, and other racialized friends. It is not okay to associate the COVID-19 disease with Asians, particularly those of Chinese descent. It is not okay to conduct physical and psychological abuses towards racialized individuals. It is not okay to vandalize Asians and other marginalized owned businesses. We must stop normalizing and stop accepting racist conducts and hate speeches towards all racialized communities. Rather, in these unprecedented times of global pandemic, together, we must educate ourselves and others and be eager to understand race, systemic racism, and racial justice in Canada and elsewhere. Remember, whoever, wherever, and whenever we are humankind. We must learn to stand together as citizens of the world for a healthier, safer, and happier community.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to Some Days by Jay Wood. Up now is an interview with Olivia from Reklalk. This interview is in collaboration with Emma, the newest member of The Avalanche Collective. That's up now. So hi, Olivia. Do you mind introducing yourself to the audience and a bit work that you do regarding housing rights?
Yes. Hi, my name is Olivia. I'm a community organizer with the RECLALC, which is the Regroupement des Comités Logements et Association des Locataires du Québec. It's a bit of a mouthful, but it's ultimately a coalition working with housing committees and tenant associations across Quebec. A lot of the work that we do is around advocacy and taking direction from tenants on the ground filtered through the community workers that support them in defending their rights and taking that to the next level and organizing campaigns around the most pressing needs that tenants face. And ultimately, as many people are aware right now, we're in a housing crisis that continuing to escalate. So there's no end of work around that. Our mandate is continually shifting, and we redirect sort of according to what our members are really looking for. And so part of our main campaign right now is centered around mandatory rent control and control measures to curb this housing crisis that we're living through and bringing solutions to the provincial level. And this obviously has a bearing on a lot of our other work focuses, including discrimination, which we just released a report on the systemic discrimination that tenants face at sort of each step of the rental process.
So as you mentioned, Montreal is currently in a housing crisis, and as a result, housing is incredibly difficult to find, with an increasing amount of renters having shared their experience with discrimination during the rental process. You recently published a document detailing some of these experiences. Would you be able to speak about what you found while compiling this report?
Yes. Well, I mean, first I'd say that it's really difficult to compile this kind of report. There's a demand for statistics. There's always a demand for statistics about what tenants are facing. And when it comes to discrimination, it's really difficult to turn those experiences into statistics. So what we're sort of trying to do with these reports, this is the third time we've produced one, is to really get a sense of people's experiences on the ground, experiences looking for housing and sort of at each step of the way, and to be able to sort of, to a certain extent, like share maybe a grouping of these experiences that are obviously representative of the larger crisis and indicative of, you know, something that we know is real, and to have these voices and to share these experiences is a way of also being able to demonstrate out to what extent this is affecting people.
So how did you gather these testimonials for the report? And would you say that the practice of discrimination through the rental process is common throughout Quebec?
So in terms of collecting data, we always work with our housing committees. And so they are the frontline workers who are speaking directly to tenants. And so we were able to collect testimonies that way. But we also found that this is something that I think a lot of people have encountered, but that we found it was sort of a good avenue to also find these stories as well, was places where people find housing. So Kijiji, Marketplace, so through social media, we posted in groups, and we sort of reached out to people who had been using these avenues to find housing. And we also collected ads that landlords posted to also demonstrate, like, you know, to actually show what people or landlords are asking for, because the discrimination is happening before tenants even apply for housing. A lot of these ads are already barring access to many tenants. And so it was really to sort of show up this year. We really wanted to focus sort of step of the way and to demonstrate that, like, the barriers are so numerous and there's so many angles that, like, at this point, we need to recognize the level at which it's operating, which is the systemic level.
So in the report, you described the process of finding an apartment as an obstacle course. What are the different ways that renters may face discrimination at different steps in the house hunt?
It might be a little cheesy to do with the obstacle course, but we know it felt relevant. It felt like it is very true in that it begins, you know, at the very first step when you're attempting to look for ads, where we have to recognize that a lot of the searching is happening on the internet. And we need to recognize that a lot of people don't have access to the internet. First of all, people don't have phones necessarily. A lot of elderly people are already facing barriers before the search has even begun by having the means to look for housing, because people aren't putting posters in the windows as much anymore. And so, like, there is already a shift in how people are looking for housing. Then you would get to the actual posting or the listing for a place, and then you can already see that they're saying, we don't want kids, don't want immigrants. Like, you know, some people, it's not always that openly discriminatory, but there are already these barriers in the ads. And go on to make a first call to visit the place, and we notice that there's already a filtering process happening there, where people will often ask very invasive questions. Landlords will ask about people's financial situations. They'll be known, they'll be in basically engaging with so people with accents or names that aren't from Quebec. We've had a lot of testimonies about people being turned away on that basis. And then there's the credit check. And then, you know, it's like, it really feels like before people have even visited the apartment, there's several steps of pre-selection that can people. What we also wanted to highlight as well is that the outcome of this obstacle course is that people do often end up finding housing, but because of these obstacles, people who face multiple barriers will often end up with subpar housing. They'll end up with in situations where they're in apartments that have bed bugs, are in poor condition, and are further exploited by their landlords or paying above their means. And I mean, at this point, like I always need to highlight is that the biggest problem in this is that the housing crisis is already making landlords more selective. And so everything is being exacerbated in this process.
And what are some of the difficulties renters are experiencing this year in terms of searching for new apartments compared to years prior?
The housing crisis, what it looks like is that when the rate of an occupation is low, you know, when places are hard to find, landlords become aware of this, they can then increase rent. For a number of reasons, there's so many factors that are contributing to this crisis, but you know, the fact that real estate has really had a boom, and so people are buying buildings that are more expensive and then transferring that burden onto their tenants. And so its cost is a huge, huge factor. And this year in particular, we're actually working on our next report, which is on evaluating the average rent in Quebec. And what we're noticing too, and this is something that you were asking about in your last question, which is we're noticing that this is not just in urban centers. This is really all over Quebec that we're seeing this really steep, steep, steep increase in rents. And so people are having to leave cities to go outside of Montreal because of the cost of rents, but then throw in other factors such as you have four kids and you're a single parent, then, and you know, your name isn't a Quebecois name. God forbid you have a disability, then it's like all of a sudden the amount of housing that's even available to you is like so much smaller. And so it's really just kind of this like stewing pot of all these factors that are really have gotten significantly worse this year as opposed to last year. And it's looking like if we don't intervene, this is just going to keep going that way.
Mm-hmm. So in the publication, you share a couple examples of listings that discourage people without stable employment or people on welfare from applying. Given that disabled people are also at a higher rate than the able population to experience these factors, this could be a form of ableism. Are there any other coded ways in which landlords phrase quote-unquote criteria that discourage marginalized and multi-marginalized people from applying?
For sure. And there's so many that it's kind of difficult to sum up, but some of them, you know, some of them are more overt, certainly, and others are more insidious. You know, for instance, some landlords will talk about noise and quiet tenants, and this can be coded language for like not wanting to be disturbed or not wanting to take on anything. They don't want any fuss, basically. And so a lot of landlords are really, if they have to make their place more accessible to someone, you know, go out of their way to make their place more accommodating, then it's already, you can tell that there's a reluctance. It's not so much in the ads, so much as I would say the pre-selection process. Mm-hmm. When people call the landlords to visit the place and they're being asked these questions, often the filtering process is about the fact that landlords know that they have their pick, that they can pick anyone like that they want. And so what they're looking for are people who have the money, first of all. Absolutely. They want to make sure they're getting their money in. But this is where I think the more insidious part of someone having to disclose a disability or having to disclose about having children, having to disclose their financial situation is really complicated because landlords won't see it as overt discrimination to pick someone else over them based on the ease with which they can you know, welcome someone who fits their criteria that's not actually explicitly shared. Just, I think it's happening on a very insidious level where it's not necessarily something that like shared in the process of looking, but when people are telling us that it takes them a year or two to find lodgings because they're constantly, for some reason, they arrive at the visit and then the landlord sees that they're in a wheelchair and they say, oh, I'm sorry, it's already rented, you know? It's really just intensive. I think the selection process is just very, very coded to privilege people who fit a criteria of like wealth, race, ability, and like something that doesn't cause too many problems for a landlord, which, you know, as we know, is just is ludicrous because housing is a fundamental right.
So in the publication, you share testimonials from people with disabilities on finding accessible apartments. So what are some forms of discrimination people with disabilities may face while looking for a rental?
I think in Montreal in particular is that the way the city is built is quite inaccessible to begin with. And so ground level apartments, for instance, are more difficult to find in the first place. But I think they tend to also be more expensive because if there's access to the yard, this can be the grounds in which to increase the rent. And, you know, to find basically a lodging that's affordable would be, I think, one of the first things. But then to find also a landlord who's willing to potentially build a ramp. I think the way that this system is built, it's around this sort of economical concept of supply and demand that really cuts out the tenants, like, which is interesting because the financial burden of paying for real estate relies on tenants. Mm-hmm. But I think what makes it so difficult for anyone who has an accessibility need that needs to be met around their space and around like making their space accessible, it relies on the quote generosity of their landlord, simply because most apartments in the city aren't designed to welcome anyone with any kind of accessibility need that would require a modification in the apartment. And so I think it's the availability, but also the way that landlords don't assume that they have a responsibility in terms of making their spaces accessible as well.
Mm-hmm. So some of the accessible apartments in the city have criteria for disabled people in order to receive housing. So for example, in the report, you mentioned someone who in Villeray was looking for an apartment, but were disqualified because of their income through OMHM. So what are some other examples of this criteria and how does it impact those who fall outside those categories?
Well, some of the criteria as well is related to age. So yeah, like OMHM, like to get subsidized housing, to get accessible housing, yeah, your income needs to be low. But there's also, you know, a lot of the spaces that are better designed to welcome people with varied accessibility needs are also for people above a certain age. If you're under 65, it would also be a lot more complicated to find a space. Like I was saying, I think it's just that there's such a small percentage of lodgings that are already accessible. Most of those are also, if they are built by the city, then they don't answer the need. There's just like the need versus what's been built and what's available is disproportionate.
So what does the private market look like for accessible apartments? And how does this process differ from apartments that are not accessible?
Like across Quebec, it is quite varied. Mm-hmm. But in how they differ, like in terms of what's accessible and what's not, I would say that another element that I would add is just that often apartments that are accessible in the private market sometimes also are accompanied by additional fees for services. Mm-hmm. And for instance, what I would say in this pandemic, is that like a lot of these services are difficult to justify or explain when they're not being offered, like in a context where people can't come and like give the same quality of food, or like if people have built-in services of like care workers that come in these have obviously been affected by the pandemic. And so what we're seeing is that, like, even in places where you're paying a lot of extra money to have these services, they're not always, like, there's no way of regulating really the quality of those services and whether they're even offered in the case of the pandemic. And so I would just say that the private market is what's difficult is that all lodgings are subject to the Tribunal de Logement's guidelines. But the problem with these guidelines is that they're not enforced. They're mostly suggested. And we see this in the case of people who have trouble finding lodgings and accommodations and then must also deal with abusive rent increases, cutting their services. And we have people who were promised some support bars installed in their bathroom, for instance, and that never happening. And so, like, the recourses available to enforce these basic rights is lacking and slowed down by what's available. And this is why, in general, like, all of these accessibility needs, all of what's available, this really does always come back to the fact that this housing crisis has really taken what was already available and reduced these options and added additional barriers. And, you know, there are solutions to this, but it just feels like the options are diminishing with each passing day, and particularly facing in the face of the 1st of July coming up, there are just less options than there were even last year.
And you mentioned the process for recourse for tenants that may be subject to, for example, the denial of accessibility concerns or just any abuse by a landlord. What is the criteria like, and how does the process of the TAL further push people into precarious conditions?
I mean, there are different recourses for, you know, like intimidation, or there's, you know, depending on what you're dealing with, you may go through the Commission des droits de la personne, which is where discrimination claims are submitted. And there technically is their mandate to follow up on situations of discrimination. But to be honest, and this is the problem, for instance, yes, someone not being able to access a service and trying to basically get their landlord to follow up, is it falls upon the tenant to follow up. The tenant must send formal letters, go through a housing committee often, because it's not always clear which path to take. They often, if it's a case of bringing in a city inspector and then going to the tribunal, actually, you know, having to go through this very lengthy process to demand that basic rights be met. And a lot of these processes don't even fall within the jurisdiction of the tribunal. So, for instance, if you end up paying, let's say, a damage deposit, you sign a lease, you finally found an apartment, despite all these barriers, you sign something, and the only way that you can get this lodging is to pay a deposit, which is illegal in Quebec. If you pay it and there's no paperwork, the tribunal won't judge on that fact, on this case. They won't actually be able to enforce a repayment of a damage deposit despite it being illegal. So there's all these loopholes, and there's all these parts of the rental process. Like, if you see an ad where there's discrimination, reporting it, it won't help you get access to an apartment. It's not actually going to help you find lodgings. You can just report this person, but the actual follow through isn't there. And this is what we're asking for, is accountability at, like, all these steps of the process, and that this be under the jurisdiction of the tribunal, because it doesn't make sense that it be so difficult, and that at the same time, tenants have to constantly fight at every step of the way to get just their basic needs met.
So how does the co-op process differ from the rental market, and how do these instances of discrimination arise?
I mean, it's difficult with co-ops because co-ops are, ultimately, they are subject to what the tribunal's guidelines, but co-ops have their own rules as well. And it's difficult because I don't want to knock co-ops, but sometimes what can happen is that there are these, you know, there are boards in the co-ops, and there can be, you know, it's a lot of nepotism. There can be a lot of power tripping, I guess, in these processes. And so also there are like specific rules about what size of lodging, for instance, you're allowed as a single person. And I'm not sure if this is the instance you're referring to, but I've certainly encountered situations where, for instance, a young person was living with their parent who I think they were in a 4.5 or 5.5 and their parent died. And this person needed to be in like a fairly big lodging or had some accessibility needs that made them want to also be in this place. Also, their parents had been, I think, in that apartment for 20 plus years, but they were kicked out because they were a single person living in an apartment of that was beyond the size attributed to one person. I think there are rules that co-ops have that do complicate access to housing, because if, you know, you already have sort of the guidelines of the tribunal, and then there's also maybe additional rules imposed by the co-op structure, it can create an added layer of discrimination sometimes. It also, you know, sometimes it can be helpful. I know that people can get into co-ops when they weren't able to find anything else. But as we know, also there is just extremely long wait times. And so the selection process for co-ops isn't immune from this discrimination as well, and from imposing certain rules upon prospective tenants. And I do think that income is a factor. I think we've had situations with people who were like substance use and noise, and these things are very, very regulated by the board. And so this does create additional barriers, I think, sometimes.
So in the report, you mentioned that often tenants accept substandard conditions due to the rental market. Could you elaborate on this?
It's particularly people in precarious situations or who are experiencing one or more sort of discriminatory sort of element is that when there's less options than, for instance, you know, a white person with a good income. And what happens is that actually people who have more money end up in cheaper places, better conditions, because of this systemic discrimination. And so people who experience intersectional forms of oppression and who experience these obstacles, it's, you know, you end up picking what you can find. And this ends up being, you know, apartments that are further away from workplaces, that are more expensive, that often are, you know, dealing with these landlords who own multiple buildings, will kick people out at a moment's notice, do have like extremely substandard conditions in terms of, you know, the renovation, recurring bed problems. You know, when you're out of options, people and, you know, landlords capitalize on that because they know that they don't actually need to do anything really to maintain their lodgings. They don't actually have to do any kind of renovation to their apartment because they know they'll still rent. One of these problems is that people who are already experiencing difficulties are now living in worse places and further away and in worse conditions.
How does Montreal's housing crisis differ from other cities in the province?
We're a bigger city, and so we have, you know, there's more housing in Montreal and more turnover. People do end up finding something. I think the conditions can sometimes be worse, but there's more of a spectrum. I would say there's more variety in the housing that you can find. But it's interesting. We work with housing committees across Quebec. And what's really complicated about some of these smaller towns is, for instance, you know, you may have heard of this town called Saint-Calixte, just outside of Montreal, where one landlord owns 80% of the housing in the area. And many of the buildings were built within 5 years, which means they aren't subject to the same norms when it comes to rent increases. And so people were getting rent increase notices of $300 extra a month. And that's just one isolated case. But I think the housing crisis, it has expanded beyond the cities and it's sometimes intensified. And it is like a microcosm of the situation because certain places are just like Laurentians or, you know, like people are having to literally leave town because there's nothing available. You know, in Montreal, you'll look around, you know, maybe eventually you'll find something that was a bit further, a bit substandard, or, you know, you'll end up finding something. But in a lot of these smaller towns, sometimes there are no options. And what we're seeing is especially, you know, and that's been exacerbated by Airbnb, it's been like the tourism industry. And I think we need to remember that, I mean, I certainly feel like as someone living in a bigger city that I think it's very clear that this housing crisis has been happening for a long time and it looks different in the cities. I would say where it gets worse in Montreal and bigger city centers is that rent evictions, repossessions are really sort of the flavor of the day. People in these bigger cities, a lot of repossessions and a lot of, you know, major renovations because there is a lot of money in the city. And so landlords are kicking out low-income people or people who have been there for a long time and are paying low rent and then renovating and then re-renting for, you know, double, triple the price. And so that's, I think people, landlords can get away with that a lot more in cities. But across Quebec, it's happening in different ways. And each region has its own sort of set of problematic renting practices and the consequences of the housing crisis, I would say.
The current vacancy rate for the island is around 3% after hitting a 15-year low in 2019. What explains this change in vacancy and why does the trend not translate for an easier rental search this year?
Yeah, so that's actually something that landlords love to throw around and say more vacancy now than last year and so forth. But it's all relative because there's maybe more apartments that are available, but they're at much, much higher prices. And so what use is an available apartment if it's so prohibitively expensive that no one can rent it, right? And so I think it, you have to kind of take it with a grain of salt. I think the occupancy rates is, it, I mean, for sure, vacancy is a way of quantifying what's available and of demonstrating that there isn't much or there is maybe more available. But ultimately, I think it doesn't represent the reality, which is that it doesn't matter if there's vacant apartments, if no one can afford them or access them, then it's not actually really helping tenants, particularly low-income tenants. So I think that sometimes we need to be a little bit wary of the vacancy rate for percentages, because I don't think they actually fully illustrate the situation.
So why is it difficult to collect data on housing discrimination?
Well, I think for the most part is that people don't know where to share their stories. People are reluctant to do it. I think it's also so widespread that often people feel like, what's the point? And I don't blame people, because it is so difficult to find justice and it's so difficult to be supported, really. And I mean, I've been speaking to a lot of tenants and sometimes they're just shocked to speak to a person. They're like, I don't even have someone to talk to. And sometimes there's no outlet. I mean, there is the Commission des droits de la personne, but they don't have sufficient means to really get results. And so I think it's a combination maybe of the lack of avenues for people to share these stories. I think it's people are also a bit disillusioned. And then also people, you know, it takes a lot of energy to look for housing. A lot of people will face this barrier and then pick up and go on to the next thing. You know, people need to find housing. They need to not be homeless on July 1st. It feels like there's a very disempowering, but also very silencing effect within this housing crisis. People are saying, oh, well, this is just how it is. And I mean, obviously, I don't think it needs to be that way. It's so widespread at this point that it's people aren't as surprised to experience it. But I think not having maybe that support to deal with discrimination is one of the key problems.
So what are some of the policies or practices that your organization would recommend in order to address discrimination in the rental market?
Well, we'd like the Tribunal Administratif du Logement to have, which is formally called the Régie du Logement, most people know it as that. We'd like them to have more of a jurisdiction over the entire rental process so that there are more recourses when people encounter discrimination when looking for housing. And so this would look like getting the tribunal to be able to enforce or to be able to respond to discriminatory ads and the like. But I mean, ultimately, like I would say, you know, and I would also say that the Commission des droits de la personne also could have more additional means to be able to act and support people. But I think for me, it comes back to our main campaign, which isn't about discrimination, but it's about rent control. And this is when you address the underlying problem. You know, I think part of me is a bit, and I think what the Réclac is about is that we want to, you know, there's addressing the everyday discrimination, but so much of this is the result of these underlying problems that are systemic that also have some solutions, which is that the housing crisis can be curbed by mandatory rent control. It can be curbed by having a rent registry, which is where it would basically fall on landlords to register the amount of rent they're charging. And that would stop them from increasing their rent the next year, because prospective tenant would be able to look and say, well, this is what the rent is. by having a rent registry, they would also maybe be able to have more follow-up with delinquent landlords, you know, like being able to know which landlords are constantly going to the tribunal, have a lot of cases and have a record of being discriminatory. And so, like I was saying, so much of this is exacerbated by the housing crisis. And it's not that mandatory rent control or a rent registry would like eliminate discrimination, but I think it was certainly undercut the system that is producing these conditions. And I think that what's important, it would, you know, it would curb evictions, it would increase the availability of cheaper housing and hold landlords accountable. The process and the burden would have to fall on landlords and not on tenants to constantly defend their rights.
What should renters do if they see a discriminatory ad?
So as it is, it's possible to share that with the Commission des droits de la personne. That would be one of the ways. There's a hotline, or it's always good to take a screenshot of these ads. Oftentimes landlords will write up their own interview forms where, you know, they may ask some invasive questions. And I also think in general, it's really, really important for tenants to be able to know what their rights are, because, you know, a lot of times people are given false information, or, I mean, I'm not gonna lie, there's a lot to know, and it's a lot of it's bureaucratic and it's difficult, but I would suggest, I mean, people can always access resources on our website, which is reclalq.qc.ca. People can check out, we have a section on of resources around like what to expect in the rental process. So, you know, a lot of people don't know that asking for a deposit is illegal beyond the first month of rent, or people don't know that they're allowed to say no to a rent increase, or they can refuse an eviction or repossession on certain grounds. I think knowing your rights is a big part of making sure that you can stay in your apartment, or that you can access certain services. And I think housing committees are a huge part of that. They're like underfunded, overworked, and doing such incredible work, but they are there to also help tenants in that process. But when it comes to discrimination, yeah, I think it really is to be able to document this, and I think we need to be able to have this conversation more often. And I think the Commission des droits de la personne is one way of doing it. But I also think that, you know, sharing these amongst tenants and being able to continue to have this conversation is sort of fueling solutions. It's all linking up to maybe, you know, potentially being able to find longer term solutions as well.
And what should renters do if they themselves experience discrimination in their search for a rental?
I'm kind of, unfortunately, a bit of a broken record, because the recourses is the Commission des droits de la personne. Mm-hmm. When you call them, they can contact the landlord to remind them of their obligation. So for some people that does work, it can be enough. But the problem is that if you're already encountering obstacles before having moved in, it can be difficult, you know, and this is often the problem, is because of the power dynamic that exists between landlord and tenant. If, you know, you're dealing with a racist landlord who doesn't want you to move in, and you call the Commission des droits de la personne and you manage to move in, but you're then dealing with like a racist landlord on an everyday basis who has a power over you, it's hard, you know, it's hard to be like, yes, that will be the solution, you know, because it is sometimes possible to find a short-term solution. And if like the goal is to access housing, but I think it's difficult because the quality of life and to be able to enjoy and like to live in your home and to feel like this is your home and that you're welcome there has a bigger problem. And sometimes, you know, there are some recourses at the Commission des droits de la personne, or if you're dealing with some service that aren't being fulfilled because of this, there are recourses. But it's, you know, I think there's a lot of conversations that need to happen around being, you know, able to like break your lease more easily, or, you know, there needs to be more solutions to being able to leave situations with abusive landlords and to also hold them accountable.
And what options do people have if they don't find an apartment by July 1st?
This is the biggest thing we're asking right now. The FECLAG is we're asking for a plan. We're asking for a plan from the CAC, from at the provincial level. We were told that there would be a plan regarding July 1st, because that is an excellent question. What is going to happen to people who don't find lodging? There is a service in Montreal and in Quebec City called Reloge. That is the OMHM and OMHQ run that helps people find lodgings and helps people find accommodations, but it doesn't address the fact that there needs to be more housing available. And this is what we're asking for. We're asking for a comprehensive plan around July 1st. And we're asking that it also take into account discrimination as well, because, you know, if this plan is only going to help people who already have better access to housing, then it doesn't really address the problem. So the Recalc is asking for a plan that takes into account all renters and all tenants in order to make more housing available and to also to address the conditions of this housing crisis. Unfortunately, they haven't acknowledge the housing crisis. So this is, it's difficult, but this is where the pressure needs to come. We need to absolutely pressure them. And, you know, we're in June. It's time is running out. We need a plan now. And we're going to keep pushing and pushing because there needs to be an acknowledgement of the housing crisis. But I mean, beyond that, those are just words. They won't acknowledge the housing crisis. They don't acknowledge systemic discrimination. They don't acknowledge racism in this province. And so fine, if they're not going to see that, you know, at the very least, can we get some kind of plan? Call it what you like, but people are going to be homeless on July 1st. And so it's a very urgent problem and there needs to be some kind of solution.
So do you have any upcoming projects listeners should look out for? And how would listeners find more information about your organization?
If you are in Montreal, we have a big protest coming up on June 19th, meeting up at Square Saint-Louis at 1:30. And that protest is about this housing crisis. It's about evictions. And we'll be walking down to Legault's office in Montreal. In part, I mean, it's hard to say, but you know, if there's no plan for July 1st, then we'll be knocking on the door and asking for that. So it's to maintain the pressure. I think it's really to remind this provincial government that housing, you know, they're starting to talk about it, but they're not really addressing it. They're not talking about it enough and they're certainly not offering solutions. So it's to definitely keep the pressure up. There are also some other events that are groups organizing. There is an event organized by the Association des Locataires de Villeray on June 12th. They're going to be doing a tour of the neighborhood with some tenants who are being evicted about the situation. And they have some very cute signs that are like parodies of for rent signs, but are saying run evicted, call here. and then the Papyr in the Southwest is also having an event on June 22nd. Anyways, there's going to be more to come, lots more events, and also our report on the average price of housing, like based on Kijiji ads and marketplace, is coming out at the end of the month. But for all these events and more, and if you want to get involved at any level, you can visit our website. It's reclalq.qc.ca. And a lot of our events will also be shared on Facebook, on our Facebook page. And so that would be also a great place to check out future events. And I would also say that if you do have a housing related question, if you're experiencing discrimination in your search for housing, I can give you the number for the hotline. It's 1-800-361-6477. And if you wanted to check out the report that has, you know, a lot of what we've talked about, it's on our website as well.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Olivia.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I gotta let you go. I have to get my Lake Magog vaccine.
Your Lake Magog vaccine?
Yeah, you know, I'm really looking forward to having the whole family to the cottage for my annual cookout.
Smart move. I'm gonna ask for the Montreal vaccine. I miss those last-minute get-togethers with my buddies.
Nice. Well, I gotta run. I don't think it protects against lateness.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Hello, listeners. This is Gambletron and Johnny Forever. Join us here on CKUT Friday, June 18th from 3 to 5 p.m. for a live broadcast of our performance Thin Walls Bad Internet co-presented by Underfine Radio and Suoni Purilpopola. And utilize your flesh body to come watch us on June 18th to the 21st live at 6835 Plaza Saint-Hubert as we build a pirate radio station and resonant sound sculpture from construction site detritus. Over Zoom. To find out more, visit undefinedradio.fm.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize?
Consciousness is affected.
There is this thing.
On.
There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize?
Our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news have brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche. You are just listening to the song Athens by Red Columns. And that completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalanche@ckut.ca or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or news@ckut.ca. Stay tuned for Jose, that's up next.
You need quality sounds? Tune into CKUT 90.3 on the frequency modulation band radio. www.ckut.ca on the internet. Streaming audio, archive shows, and information.
CKUT. Wow.
CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. No boundaries. Feel alive.
Hey, you. Come over here and listen.
Oh, God, I'm so fucking wet. Yeah. Yeah.
It's time for Audio Smut.
This conversation was recorded on colonized Indigenous land, which has long served as a site of meeting and exchange amongst many First Nations, including the Gagnegahage, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, Huron-Wendat, Abenaki, and Anishinaabe. The Gagnegahage people are recognized as the custodians of the lands and waters which nourish and sustain those of us who live on this territory, known as Jajage. If you have the means to donate, please offer to support Raven Trust. You can find them at raventrust.com. A registered charity that raises legal defense funds to assist Indigenous peoples who enforce their rights and title to protect their traditional territories. As white-bodied settlers who non-consensually occupy colonized Indigenous territory, I want to call out the complexities in sharing this discussion centered on self-pleasure and mindful embodiment as liberatory praxis. The separation of mind and soma is a tool of colonization and white supremacy. It's the cultures and understandings of bodies of color that most often are the originators and keepers of these wisdoms. We are sharing our awareness and personal experience with great gratitude and reverence for this knowledge.
Yeah, so my name is Ilana Bordelique. I'm a trans woman. I am